Ladies and gentlemen, there is no evidence for the soup. It's assumed there was a soup because there are people today, therefore it had to start somewhere. But the fact of the matter is, when you come to hard evidence, there is no evidence for the soup ever having existed. By the way, it gets worse. Now, these men go on writing, "It is becoming clear that however life began on Earth, the usually conceived notion that life emerged from an oceanic soup of organic chemicals is a most implausible hypothesis. We may therefore, with fairness, call this scenario the myth of the prebiotic soup." I love it. Here are three guys that believe in evolution, and yet, looking at the facts of the situation, they say, well, there's a myth of a prebiotic soup. I said it gets worse. Continuing to read in their book, I'm sure all of you have heard of the early soup, and of course the atmosphere, the atmospheric conditions around the soup, were supposed to have been a reducing atmosphere, because in a reducing atmosphere, things are not destroyed. The proteins would not tend to be destroyed as quickly as in an oxidizing atmosphere like we have today, where our atmosphere is 20% oxygen. Again, the reducing nature of the proposed early atmosphere is now being questioned. From their book I'm reading, "The early atmosphere of the Earth was examined and found not to be the strong reducing atmosphere popularized for the past 30 years. Instead, the consensus of scientists about the early atmosphere is shifting. At the time of this writing, there is wide agreement in adopting a more neutral primitive atmosphere consisting of CO2, nitrogen, water, and perhaps 1% hydrogen. There is a current controversy concerning whether the early Earth and its atmosphere might actually have been oxidizing. The accumulating evidence for an oxygenic early Earth and atmosphere heightens the mystery of life's origin." So not only is there no evidence for a prebiotic soup out of which life could have arisen, but actually the atmospheric conditions that were supposed to surround that soup and then set up the stage for life's occurring, even that, the information that we're now gaining from rock samples and whatever, that's being called into question too. What do we call this life from non-life then? We certainly can't call it science. I'd call it religion. You want to believe there was a bunch of gluck around someplace and then just in a naturalistic, mechanistic way life arose, and that's science? No, I don't think so. Another thing that's becoming very clear, and I want to read from page 72 of their book, "For Being Evolutionists." This is a very helpful book to me. "When you look at the rock stratas, the geologists have assigned time periods to these rocks, and some are early and some are late. On page 72 of The Mystery of Life's Origin, they write, Brooks and Shaw state that the oldest rocks on Earth are probably about 3.98 billion years old. However, the oldest age confirmed by dating techniques is 3.8 billion years for the rocks from the Isua series in Greenland. In either case, the surprising implication is that we may almost say that life has always existed on Earth. Before 3.98 billion years ago, from 4.6 to 3.98 billion years, the Earth was probably too hot to support life. Then life appeared about 3.81 billion years ago. That is, only 0.170 billion, or 170 million years, were available for the abiotic emergence of life. Indeed, according to Brooks and Shaw, this amount of time for the abiogenic synthesis of essential precursors, let alone chemical evolution, is, quote, very small. Now, what's being stated here? What's being stated is, if we can date the rocks, which I would dispute anyway, I'm using their theory against them at this point. If we can date the rock in which we find the earliest life, and the earliest life appears only 170 million years after rocks that have no life in them, then we're saying that this evolution of life from non-life had to occur in 170 million years, which again, that isn't going to happen. That isn't enough time. So there's no soup. We've got the wrong type of atmosphere to produce life, and we don't have enough time to produce life in. Pretty interesting from those people that want to believe that evolution have occurred. They've got to deal with their own facts, the facts that are being discovered in the geological world. They've got to deal with those. Something now that's being proposed, I'm not going to go into. You can read about it in Darwin on Trial by Johnson, and you can read about it in a number of other publications. The difficulty of producing life from non-life is been looked at from a number of different angles, and one of the things that's being stated now is that the first actual proteins might have used clay crystals or crystals in the clay and formed around those clay crystals and thus came to an order in the same way that a crystal will have an order, and that as these biological particles, these proteins surrounded the clay particles, that gave them the order they needed to become life, which again, that's a new theory. You can read about it. I think it's hogwash, obviously. We're still making something non-living becoming something living. On page 186 and page 187 of their book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, these men write a conclusion, and I wanted to read you part of it. They write, "A major conclusion to be drawn from this work is that the undirected flow of energy through a primordial atmosphere in ocean is at present a woefully inadequate explanation for the incredible complexity associated with even simple living systems, and is probably wrong. Many will find this critique interesting, but will not draw the same conclusions we have. Why will many predictively persist in their acceptance of some version of chemical evolution? Quite simply, because chemical evolution has not been falsified." Now remember that early on when we read about the definition of a science, you have to be able to falsify a science. You can't falsify a religion. But a science, you have to be able to test it, and by testing it, you have to be able to falsify it. No, I wasn't around 4.8 billion years ago or whatever, so no, I didn't see that life didn't come out of a soup, despite the fact there's no evidence for a soup. But their conclusion is interesting. Why is it that many will persist in believing, against all the mathematical and chemical and geological arguments, why is it many will persist in believing that life arose from dead inanimate matter? Quite simply, because chemical evolution has not been falsified. Enough said on chemical evolution. What's the next step? Well, the next step is, well, if evolution didn't arise here on Earth, then maybe it arose somewhere else. And I'm reading from Darwin on Trial by Philip Johnson. "Assuming away the difficult points is one way to solve an intractable problem. Another is to send the problem off into space. That was the strategy of one of the world's most famous scientists, Francis Crick, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA. Crick is thoroughly aware of the awesome complexity of cellular life in the extreme difficulty of explaining how such life could have evolved in the time available on Earth. So he speculated that conditions might have been more favorable on some distant planet. That move leaves the problem of getting life from the planet of origin to Earth. First in a paper with Leslie Orgel, then in a book of his own, Crick advanced a theory he called, quote, directed panspermia. The basic idea is that an advanced extraterrestrial civilization, possibly facing extinction, sent primitive life forms to Earth in a spaceship. The spaceship builders couldn't come themselves because of the enormous time required for interstellar travel, so they sent bacteria capable of surviving the voyage and the severe conditions that would have greeted them upon arrival on the early Earth. What kind of scientific evidence supports directed panspermia? Crick wrote that if the theory is true, we should expect that cellular microorganisms would appear suddenly without evidence that any simpler forms preceded them. We should also expect to find that the early forms were distinctly related but highly distinct, distantly related but highly distinct, with no evidence of ancestors because these existed only on the original planet. This expectation fits the facts perfectly because the archaebacteria and eubacteria at the same time too different to have evolved from a common ancestor in the time available, yet also too similar, sharing the same genetic language, not to have a common source somewhere." Now, the reason I took the time to read this is because this has become, in many places, fairly widely believed. once you come face to face with the fact that from the mathematical evidence, from the geological evidence, from the time scales involved, life simply could not have evolved on this planet. If you're going to continue to believe in evolution, then it's helpful if you can believe that life came here from some other planet. Then we get rid of the evolution problem entirely, at least the origin of life problem. We get rid of that entirely, and now we have the primitive forms of life here on Earth that can begin to evolve and form what we now see around us. Hey, if you want to believe that, that's fine. But let's be honest, that's religion. I mean, if you believe that a long time ago on a faraway planet, some people that couldn't come here themselves stuck bacteria on a spaceship and sent it off to Earth, I mean, that's fine, but that's not science. And ladies and gentlemen, a major point, again, of this teaching is to show the beliefs and the undergirding structure of evolution is not scientific in the distinct sense of the word, no more so than what we believe about creation. There's a crime scene, if you will. It's called the life around you and you. Now, carrying the case to its full conclusion in the origin of the species and in the descent of man, he was forced to assume that an unbroken chain of organisms intermediate between the first forms of life and man. Here was a theory hopefully subject to proof. Where was the proof? Where were the bones of this multitude of organisms? Surely many of them should have survived in the earth. Yet the fossils found up to Darwin's day, including those unearthed by Cuvier, etc., etc., supplied only the most fragmentary evidence. Where were the missing links? Now, in Darwin's day, there were plenty of missing links. Guess what? There still are plenty of missing links. Many, many missing links. Back to reading from Darwin on Trial. Today, it is widely assumed that the existence of fossil remains of numerous extinct species necessarily implies evolution. And most people are unaware that Darwin's most formidable opponents were not clergymen, but fossil experts. And that's a good point, because the fossil experts had been the ones digging around in the ground, and when Darwin proposed this unbroken chain, they kind of looked up from their holes in the ground and said, "Huh? You're nuts. What unbroken chain? There's no chain." Johnson goes on to write, "Each of the divisions of the biological world, kingdoms, phyla, classes, orders, it was noted, conformed to a basic structural plan, with very few intermediate types. Where were the links between these discontinuous groups? The absence of transitional intermediates was troubling even to Darwin's loyal supporter T.H. Huxley, who warned Darwin repeatedly, in private, that a theory consistent with the evidence would have to allow for some big jumps. Darwin posed the question himself, asking, why, and he's quoting Darwin here, why, if species have descended from other species by insensibly fine graduations, do we not everywhere see innumerable transitional forms? Why is not all nature in confusion, instead of the species being as we see them, well defined? Why indeed? Darwin, who asked the question still remains. Darwin's question that he asked himself still remains. Johnson goes on to write, but what if the necessary links are missing not only from the world of the present, but from the fossil record of the past as well? Darwin acknowledged that his theory implied that, quote, the number of intermediate and transitional links between all living and extinct species must have been inconceivably great. One might therefore suppose that geologists would be continually uncovering fossil evidence of transitional forms. This, however, was clearly not the case. What geologists did discover was species and groups of species, which appeared suddenly rather than at the end of a chain of evolutionary links. Darwin conceded that the state of the fossil evidence was, quote, the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. That's amazing. That's Darwin's own words. That Darwin said that the fossil evidence was, quote, the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory, unquote. And that it accounted for the fact that, quote, All the most eminent paleontologists and all our greatest geologists have unanimously, often vehemently, maintained the immutability of the species, end quote. Now, Darwin argued eloquently that the fossil problem, although conceded serious, was not fatal to his theory. His main point, and note this, his main point was that the fossil record was extremely imperfect. Darwin said, quote, I do not pretend that I should ever have suspected how poor a record of the mutations of life the best preserved geological section presented, had not the difficulty of our not discovering innumerable transitional links between the species which appeared at the commencement and close of each formation pressed so hardly on my theory. So Darwin basically is saying, well, these transitional forms ought to be there. They're not there. Gee, wonder why. Darwin has stated that the lack of fossil evidence has been a real thorn in the side to his theory, that his theory would predict innumerable transitional forms. And Darwin's greatest opponents alive in his day were the fossil experts, the paleontologists, who looked and saw, no, that the theory does not fit the facts, and this is important. Again, the creation model and the evolution model. The evolution model will predict innumerable transitional forms. The creation model will predict that what would be seen in the fossil record would be distinct species, distinct genera. What do we see? Distinct. That's exactly what we see. Some might say, but I've seen this with my own eyes. I've seen this transition. There's a horse, and it started out with a little bitty horse, about the size of a cat. And now it's this big horse, and I've seen that with my own eyes, how that developed. Have we really? Let me read from Norman Macbeth's book, Darwin Retried. At this point, the attentive reader will object that he has seen charts of descent with his own eyes, particularly those showing the process of horses, from the tiny Eohippus to the modern Equus. This is correct. He has seen precisely this picture on a number of occasions. But this leads to a story that's very embarrassing to the profession. I give it in Hardin's summary, quote, there was a time when the existing fossils of horses seemed to indicate a straight-line evolution from small to large, from dog-like to horse-like, from animals with simple grinding teeth to animals with complicated cusps of the modern horse. It looked straight-line, like the links of a chain, but not for long. As more fossils were uncovered, the chain splayed out into the usual phylogenetic net, and it was all too apparent that evolution had not been in a straight line at all, but that, to consider size only, horses had now grown taller, now shorter, with the passage of time. Unfortunately, before the picture was completely clear, an exhibit of horses as an example of orthogenesis had been set up at the American Museum of Natural History, photographed and much reproduced in elementary textbooks. Hardin is right, now back to Macbeth. Hardin is right in saying this misleading picture is still being reprinted today, if only in elementary textbooks rather than in professional literature. I find this double standard improper and unwise, and hence am happy to add that it's not been adopted by the entire profession. In 1967, my daughter showed me the textbook used in her freshman geology course at Smith College. The author, a Yale professor emeritus, printed a similar picture and credited it to the Yale Peabody Museum. I wrote to the museum, quoting Hardin, and asked how I could explain the situation to my daughter. I received a prompt and courteous reply from Professor Carl M. Wagge, saying that the picture was perhaps misleading in the elementary book, that he would certainly be collaborating on the next edition, and that he would certainly make a change. His embarrassment was obvious. There are a few evolutionists that might be embarrassed by the fact that this picture of a horse, and many, many, many of us have seen it, where you start with a little tiny horse and you get to the big horse, and this is a proof for evolution. In fact, this appears, this picture and this caption appears in the Life Nature Library on Evolution, on page 112 and 113, we have the stages of the horse. You start with this little tiny horse, Eohippus, and the book says it's Eohippus. It lived in the Eocene period. It was 58 million years old. And then you go to Mesohippus, and that was in the Oligocene, and it was 36 million years old. And then you go to Merychippus, and that was in the Miocene, and it was 25 million years ago. And then
Philohippus, and that was in the Pliocene era, 13 million years ago, and then Equus, and that's recent, started about a million years ago, and so there's this whole horse series. Note their caption beside the horse series. The development of the modern horse has been traced back some 60 million years from the tall animal of today to a short-necked creature not much larger than a domestic cat. Originally, the horse was a forest dweller with many toes, well adapted to travel on soft, moist earth of tropical North America. As the climate grew colder and the forest thinned into an open grassy plain, the horse slowly developed hard single toes for traveling on dry land and complicated grinding teeth for feeding on the scanty herbage of the Great Plateau. That's a nifty caption. It's just totally wrong. The caption is totally wrong. The picture is totally wrong. It simply didn't happen that way. In the technical language, I'd call it a lie. It didn't happen that way. The amazing thing is that when this book, this Life Nature Library on Evolution, was printed, when this picture was printed and this caption was written, the evidence was well known that it didn't happen this way. That did not keep them from printing the picture or printing the caption. And this has been the point in many, many cases. A lot of times you'll hear people say, well, if we can get the younger children, if we can get them to understand the theory and the concept by pictures such as this, then later on we'll be able to tell them more about some of the concerns and the problems that we have with the evolution and, of course, the real situation. I, like Macbeth, say I find the double standard unwise. If you've got a case for evolution, make it. If a case doesn't exist, don't make up a picture, make up a sequence, make up a way how this little horse was once a forest dweller and then it developed to live on the plain. Don't make all that up in a big, huge lie and then present it and say, well, but this teaches little kids how it's supposed to work. If you've got a good case for evolution, make it. If you haven't, then I would say that the evidence supports creation, that there is fossil evidence for a whole bunch of different types of horses in the fossil record. But the fact of the matter is, there's no common ancestry at all, which is exactly what we would predict if the creation model were right. By the way, for more on the horse, because there's some more work on that that's been done to show more exactly the different types of the horse and that type of thing, if you were going to do a paper or wanted to read more on it, in Dwayne Gish's book, Evolution, The Challenge of the Fossil Record, he does a real good work on the horse and takes us several pages to do that. Now, part of the fossil evidence, and there's something that's got to be understood here, and that is that when we're dealing with the fossil evidence, if you're talking to an evolutionist, then he's going to be talking about the position of the fossils in something that's known as the geologic column. And the geologic column is the stratification that you see on the top of the earth, or the stratification that is assumed to be, I should say, actually on the top of the earth. Now, there is quite a bit written on the geologic column by creationists. You might want to look at The Genesis Flood by Henry Morris. But I'm going to read just briefly from an Impact article. Again, Impact is some articles produced by the Institute for Creation Research. And this is their November 1984 Impact article on 10 misconceptions about the geologic column. Misconception number one, the geologic column was constructed by geologists who, because of the weight of evidence they had found, were convinced of the truth of uniformitarian theory and organic evolution. It may sound surprising, but the standard geologic column was devised before 1860 by catastrophists who were creationists. Adam Sedgwick, Roderick Murchison, and William Conybear and others affirmed that the early Earth, or the Earth, was formed by largely catastrophic processes and that the Earth and life were created. So the geologic column was not discovered or pieced together by evolutionists, but by creationists. Misconception number two. Geologists composed the geologic column by assembling the periods and eras which they had recognized. They answer, the geologic column was not composed by assembling a chronology of periods, eras, or other supposed measures of time. but by the superposition of objectively defined sequences of sedimentary strata called systems. The periods and eras were later appended to the system nomenclature of the geologic column, transforming it into a geologic time scale. In other words, as originally conceived, the geologic column was simply the statement of fact, what layer of strata was where. Misconception number three. The strata systems of the geologic column are worldwide in their occurrence, with each strata system being present below any point on the Earth's surface. And the answer, the notion that the Earth's crust has an onion skin structure with successive layers containing all the strata systems distributed on a global scale is not according to the facts. The entire geologic column, composed of complete strata systems, exists only in the diagrams drawn by geologists. Ladies and gentlemen, there is, in fact, no place on Earth that you can go and look at the geologic column. What actually occurs is different strata systems on different places on the Earth. Then evolutionary geologists putting together the systems with fossil records have built what you now see in the textbooks. Misconception number four. Strata systems always occur in the order required by the geologic column. That's false. ICR writes, hundreds of locations are known where the order of systems identified by geologists does not match the geologic column. And misconception number seven, sedimentary evidence proves that the periods of millions of years of duration were required to deposit individual strata systems. And the answer, before radiometric dating was devised, uniformitarian geologists postulated periods of millions of years duration to slowly deposit the strata systems. A single sedimentary lamina or bed was supposed by uniformitarian geologists to represent typically a year or many years duration. It was concluded, therefore, that multiplied thousands of lamina and beds superimposed required millions of years. Recently, however, geologists have discovered that lamina and beds form quickly on floodplains of rivers during floods, in shallow marine areas during storms, and in deep water by turbidity currents. The evidence of rapid sedimentation is now so easily recognized that a geologist observing a strata system these days often asks, where to insert the missing time, of which the strata do not show sedimentary evidence. Catastrophism, quite naturally, is making a comeback. Now, it's important to realize this about geologic column, and I wanted to read you that about the geologic column as we are discussing the fossil evidence, because it is a misconception that all over the world that this column exists, that it's undisputed, that it always exists in the same order, that it's always there in every case, and that the same fossils appear in the same type of strata in every situation, and that's how geologists have made such a neat little picture of the evolution of our past. In fact, that is simply not the case, and again, I'll refer you to things like this Impact article, and I didn't read the whole by any stretch of the imagination. Also, the Genesis Flood by Henry Morris, and there are other pieces of literature that discuss the imperfections and the problems with the geologic column. When we're talking about the geologic column and we're looking at the fossil evidence, what about the fossil evidence itself? Let's go right to the heart of the matter, the fossil evidence itself. And I want to read from a book called Darwin's Enigma. Darwin's Enigma by Luther Sutherland. On page 44, he writes, most of the museums classify the deepest rocks which contain fossils of multicelled organisms as Cambrian rocks. Dr. Preston Cloud, writing in Geology Magazine in 1973, stated not a single indisputable multicellular fossil had been found anywhere in the world in a rock supposedly older than Cambrian rocks. But in the Cambrian rock is found a multitude of highly complex creatures with no ancestors. Let me read that line again. But in the Cambrian rocks is found a multitude of highly complex creatures with no ancestors. These rocks contain fossils of trilobites, brachiopods, corals, worms, clams, and soft-bodied creatures like jellyfish. As stated in a 1961 book, Prehistoric Life on Earth, the invertebrate animal phyla are all represented in Cambrian deposits. Let me read that sentence again. The invertebrate animal phyla are all represented in Cambrian deposits. It was then believed that the vertebrates had not appeared until the lower Ordovician. But in 1977, fully developed vertebra fish fossils were discovered in the upper Cambrian of Wyoming. The discovery, reported in Science magazine May 5, 1978, placed every major animal phylum in the Cambrian rocks. This extremely significant information comes as quite a shock to most people, for it is not discussed in school or in university textbooks. The museum officials, however, freely talked about the explosive appearance of complex life in the Cambrian rocks. They explained that the sudden appearance of all animal phyla with no ancestors was called the Cambrian explosion. Dr. Eldridge of the American Museum of Natural History said, quote, "There is still a tremendous problem with the sudden diversification of multicellular life. There's no question about that. That's a real phenomenon," unquote. He said that it could not be explained away with the assertion that the ancestors of Cambrian life had all soft parts and thus left no fossils, and he wasn't going to give a scenario of why he thought the explosion took place. Jellyfish, for example, have very soft parts, and yet they left distinct fossils in the Cambrian rocks. Nor can the Cambrian explosion be explained away with the assumption that Precambrian rocks were all destroyed somehow by metamorphism or erosion, for as Dr. Eldridge said, certainly that's been refuted, I think the pattern is real. What we see there is not a function of the record, it's a real biological problem. It's just that I'm kind of loath to make up stories about it. We have a real problem with testability, unquote. Up to 5,000 feet of Precambrian rock grade continuously into the Cambrian in places with no sign of a non-conformity, a long intervening period of erosion. Noted evolutionist Dr. George Gaylord Simpson has called the sudden appearance of many types of complex life forms in the Cambrian rocks the, quote, "major mystery of the history of life," end quote. In other words, what we're saying is, in the Precambrian rocks, all the major life forms do not exist, and in the Cambrian rocks, poof, all the major phyla exist. They are all there. And there's no transitionary forms, not one. Actually, there have been fossils now discovered in the Precambrian rocks, and Dr. Gish, in his book Evolution, The Challenge of the Fossil Record, discovers that, or discusses that, but again, it's simply different types of fossils, and there's no transitional forms. And if you want to read about the Precambrian fossils, you can read about them in Dr. Gish's book on pages 57 to 58. What about insects? Insects in the fossil record. I'd like to read from Dr. Gish's book, The Challenge of the Fossil Records, page 61. It says, "The absence of transitional forms leaves any evolutionary origin of insects shrouded in mystery. Some fossils are found in the Middle Devonian rocks, and they are present in such amazing numbers and varieties in rocks of the Pennsylvanian that the so-called Pennsylvanian period has been called, quote, the age of insects. Fossils of dragonflies in the Pennsylvanian rocks with a wingspan of 2 to 3 feet are not uncommon. When we first see dragonflies, big or little, they are just that. Dragonflies. That's amazing. To say that there are no transitional forms at all, the evolution model would predict that you can't get to a dragonfly with a 2-foot wingspan unless you have a whole truckload of things that would come before a dragonfly. The evolution model has no explanation for why those transitional forms cannot be found. The creation model, on the other hand, would say, yes, if God created insects like he did back in Genesis chapter 1, that if God created a dragonfly with a 2-foot wing, you would see it. Poof. Dragonflies and other insects appearing instantaneously. Gish goes on to write, "Evolutionists believe that flying insects evolved from non-flying insects. There's an ongoing argument among evolutionists on just what non-flying insect gave rise to wings. If a single intermediate between non-flying insects and flying insects could be found, the controversy would be settled. But as yet, not one fossil intermediate has ever been found. Thousands of fossils of non-flying insects have been discovered. Thousands of fossils of flying insects rest on museum shelves. Where are the thousands of intermediates that ought to exist? The most reasonable conclusion is that the transitional forms have never been found because they never existed. That's a great line of Dr. Gish's. The most reasonable conclusion is the transitional forms have never been found because they never existed. Two cops walk into a room. There's a body lying on the floor. They start gathering the evidence. They make a reasonable conclusion. If you walk into the evolution room, or if you look, walk into life's room as we see it now, with people, with a fossil record, with rocks available to us, we look around at the evidence, gee, the most reasonable conclusion is that there never were any transitional forms, because they never existed. Well, that's insects. What about plants? There's no transitional evidence leading up to insects. What about transitional evidence for plants? Reading from Darwin's Enigma by Sutherland. The origin of plants appears to be a complete mystery to evolutionists. It's difficult to find even a postulated family tree of plant life. Dr. Patterson said that he had seen a lot of published on the origin of plants, quote, although I would agree that they are not convincing, end quote. Dr. E.J. H. Corner of Cambridge University Botany School made a candid evaluation of the knowledge about plant evolution, quote, much evidence can be adduced in favor of the theory of evolution from biology, biogeography, and paleontology, but I still think that to the unprejudiced, the fossil record of plants is in favor of special creation. Now, that's an amazing statement. Here is a guy who's a botanist. He's of the Cambridge University Botany School. Now, I don't know what he knows about biogeography and paleontology and biology, but in his field of specialty, which is botany, he writes, I still think that to the unprejudiced, the fossil record of plants is in favor of special creation. Talk about a reluctant witness. Gee willikers, it's great to have a professional botanist who believes in evolution say, well, the other fields may favor evolution, but mine favors creation. Thank you, doctor. What about the change from invertebrate to vertebrate? You know, from spineless to having a spine. I'll refer back to Darwin's Enigma by Sutherland. He writes, what evidence is there in the fossil record of the origin of the subphylum vertebrata, animals with a spinal cord and a backbone? Since vertebrate fishes just abruptly appear in the Cambrian deposits of Wyoming, Wyoming is a base in the geologic column, since vertebrate fishes just abruptly appear in the Cambrian deposits of Wyoming with no ancestors leading up to them, evolutionists freely admit that there is no evidence of their evolutionary origin from invertebrates. Dr. Gish comments on this point too. He writes on page 65 of his book, the idea that vertebrates were derived from the invertebrates is purely an assumption that cannot be documented from the fossil record. On the basis of comparative anatomy and embryology of living forms, almost every invertebrate group has been proposed at one time or another is the ancestor to the vertebrates. The transition from invertebrate to vertebrate supposedly passed through a simple chordate stage, that is, a creature possessing a rod-like notochord. Does the fossil record provide evidence for such a transition? No, not at all. Incredible! 100 million years of evolution and no fossilized transitional forms? All hypotheses combined, no matter how ingenious, could ever pretend on the basis of evolutionary theory to account for a gap of such magnitude. Such facts, on the other hand, are in perfect accord with the predictions of the creation model. And Gish's point is well taken. Again, the creation model best explains what we see. So we see in the Cambrian explosion, all the animals appear with no transitional forms, all at the same time, same basic time period. What about the insects? No transitional forms. What about plants? No ancestry, no transitional forms. What about the change from the invertebrate to vertebrate? Sorry, no transitional forms. What about fish? What about fish? I'm back to Dr. Gish. A careful reading of Romer's book, Vertebrate Paleontology, seems to allow no other conclusion but that all the major fish classes are clearly and distinctly set apart from one another with no transitional form linking them. Of the typical bony fishes, Romer records the fact that their appearance in the fossil record is a, quote, dramatically sudden one, end quote. Later on, he states the common ancestors of the bony fish groups is unknown. This is an evolutionist writing. The common ancestors of the bony fish groups is unknown. There are various features, many of them noted above, in which the two typical subclasses of bony fish are already widely divergent when we first see them. End quote. Back to Gish, Earl White, an evolutionist and an expert on fishes, in his presidential address on lung fishes to the Linnaean Society of London said, quote, but whatever ideas authorities may have on the subject, the lungfishes, like every other major group of fishes that I know, have their origins firmly based in nothing, end quote. Back to Gish. Later he went on to say, quote, I have often thought how little I should like to have to prove organic evolution in a court of law, end quote. And he closed out his address by saying, quote, we still do not know the mechanics of evolution, in spite of the overconfident claims in some quarters, nor are we likely to make further progress in this by the classical methods of paleontology or biology. And we shall certainly not advance matters by jumping up and down and shrilling, Darwin is God, and I so-and-so am his prophet. Boy, is that well taken. No ancestry for life itself in the Cambrian geologic deposits. No ancestry for insects. No ancestry for plants. No ancestry or models for how invertebrates became vertebrates. No ancestry for fish. Well, now, I was always taught that fish became amphibians, and then amphibians became reptiles, etc., etc. Let's check that, quoting from Gish again. According to the assumed evolutionary sequence of life, fish gave rise to amphibia. This change would have required many millions of years and would have involved a vast multitude of transitional forms. The fossil record has been diligently searched for transitional series linking fish to amphibian, but as yet no such series has been found. The closest link that has been proposed is that allegedly existing between the Raphsidian crossopterygian fish and the amphibians of the genus, and he gives this real complicated genus. But what are the facts? Not a single transitional form has ever been found showing an intermediate stage between the fin of the crossopterygian and the foot of the ichthyostegid. The limb and the limb girdle of the ichthyostega were already of the basic amphibian type, showing no vestige of a fin ancestry. There's a basic difference in anatomy between all fish and all amphibians not bridged by transitional forms. In fish, living or fossil, the pelvic bones are small and loosely embedded in muscle. There's no connection between the pelvic bones and the vertebral column. None is needed. The pelvic bones do not and could not support the weight of the body. There are no walking fish, including the walking catfish of Florida. These latter fish do not walk, but slither along on their belly, using the same type of motion they use in the water. In tetrapod amphibians, living or fossil, on the other hand, the pelvic bones are very large and firmly attached to the vertebral column. This is the type of anatomy an animal must have to walk. It is the type of anatomy found in all living or fossil tetrapod amphibians, but which is absent in all living or fossil fishes. There are no transitional forms. See, I was taught in school that fish became an amphibian, then an amphibian became a reptile. Nice teaching. But it's religion. There's no evidence to support that it actually ever occurred. Worse than that, the evidence ought to be there. The evidence is there for all the distinct forms. It's not like there's no fossils at all. There's plenty of fossils. If evolution actually occurred, there ought to be plenty of transitional forms. There are none. If you look at insects, plants, vertebrate to invertebrate, fish, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, birds, snakes, when you look at everything that you can see in the fossil record, and in every case, every species and genus is distinct, and there's not a single transitional form, and you walk away from that saying, Well, all these things evolved into each other. I'm going to question your logic. I just don't think that logically you can draw that conclusion. Well, what about the change from the amphibian to the reptile? What about that change? Well, back to Darwin's enigma. He writes, is the picture any different regarding the first appearance of reptiles in the fossil record? Well, the answer is no, basically. He says, when Dr. Eldridge was asked about the supposed amphibian to reptile transition, he replied that some taxonomists say there is no such thing as a reptile. Dr. Eldridge continued, and in respect to amphibians, some biologists say there's no such things as amphibians either, unquote. Thus, a frog is not an amphibian or either a fish or a reptile. He said, quote, well, the reptiles are not a natural group because some are more closely related to birds and some are more closely related to mammals, unquote. And that's all he had to offer. So he sidestepped the question by suggesting in the third person that there was no such thing as a reptile. In other words, according to his contention, the reptiles such as alligators, snakes, turtles, Tyrannosaurus rex, and Brontosaurus should be called birds or mammals. It's highly unlikely that a prominent scientist such as Dr. Eldridge would make such meaningless statements if there were any actual fossils connecting amphibians with reptiles. And from Darwin on Trial by Philip Johnson, he writes, no satisfactory candidates exist to document this transition from amphibians to reptiles. There are fossil amphibians that have some reptile skeletal characteristics, but they appear too late in the fossil record, and recent evidence indicates they were true amphibians. The transition is, in any case, one that which would be hard to confirm with fossils, because the most important differences between amphibians and reptiles involve the unfossilized soft parts of their reproductive systems. Amphibians lay their eggs in water, and larvae undergo a complex metamorphosis before reaching the adult stage. Reptiles lay a hard shell-case egg, and the young are perfect replicas of adults on first emerging. No explanation exists for how an amphibian could have developed a reptilian mode of reproduction by Darwinian descent. So there aren't any transitional forms documented between reptiles and amphibians. And even though they would be tough to document, the fact of the matter is no explanation even exists in the Darwinian theory of how an amphibian could have become a reptile. We could go on and on and on. What about snakes? Is there any transitional forms for snakes? Let me read from The Neck of the Giraffe by Francis Hitching. And I don't want to beat this subject to death, but I think it's very important we see the paucity in the record, in the fossil record, for any kind of transitional form. Because as a child or as a student in school, I had always been taught and always assumed that the fossil record was very complete, and you saw these trees and how one animal became another, and you saw this horse picture, and you saw how the giraffe went from having a short neck to a tall neck, and you just assumed that that was all true. But when you really take a look at the evidence, the fact of the matter is the evidence simply isn't there. Talking about snakes, for example, Hitching writes, no zoologist doubts that snakes evolved from reptiles. The transformation of a four-legged into a legless reptile is said to have happened in several distinct varieties. Some snakes, pythons, and boas still have what seem to be relics of their hip bones inside them, and bulges on the outside where probably the legs once grew. The problem comes in explaining how the snake developed. Through a very large number of chance mutations, its unique method of locomotion, which is distinctly unreptilian. It demands an increase in the number of certain vertebrae. Without this crucial variation, snakes could not wriggle about and move in the way they do. Yet it apparently happened in several independent groups of snakes in widely differing parts of the earth and in differing periods. This is great that it happened in many different places and many different types of snakes. He goes on to write, there is no trace of any transitional stages in the fossil record. Excuse me. He just wrote earlier, no zoologist doubts snakes evolve from reptiles. No zoologist doubts that snakes evolve from reptiles. Then he writes, there is no trace of any transitional stages in the fossil record, nor has anyone ever seen in the broods of four-legged lizards a mutated monstrosity which might give a clue as to how a reptile can become both legless and perfectly adapted to a new way of locomotion and life. I would question why it is that there are no zoologists who doubt that snakes would come from reptiles. There are no transitional forms. It should be easy to document that transition. But again, no transitional forms whatsoever. That is what we would expect if we believe in special creation. What about the origin of flight? I mean, feathers are extremely specific. What about the origin of flight? Gish writes in his book, "The origin of flight should provide an excellent test case for choosing between the evolution and creation models. Almost every structure in a non-flying animal would require modification for flight, and resultant transitional forms should be easily detectable in the fossil record. Furthermore, flight is supposed to have evolved four times separately and independently in insects, birds, mammals, which would be the bats, and in reptiles, the pterosaurs now extinct. In each case, the origin of flight is supposed to have required many millions of years, and almost innumerable transitional forms would have been involved in each case." And that's a great point. I mean, you're going to evolve flight four different times. There ought to be truckloads of transitional forms. Yet Gish writes, "Yet not in a single case can anything even approaching a transitional series be produced." I think he's exactly right in this. Now, at this point, I need to point out the Archaeopteryx. Archaeopteryx is a bird that many have said proves that, yes, there is a transitional form between a reptile and a bird, that one really does exist. But that, in fact, is not the case. And I'll read from Sutherland in his book, Darwin's Enigma. "Many evolutionists believe that the most impressive evidence of an evolutionary transition is that indicating the conversion of a reptile into a bird. When the author participated in the production of six television programs at the British Royal Academy in London in June of 82 to commemorate the centennial of Charles Darwin's death, the fossil bird Archaeopteryx was offered by evolutionist experts as one of the best evidences of common ancestry evolution. According to Dr. Eldridge, the fossil bird Archaeopteryx, shown in Figure 3, had some of the advanced characteristics of birds and retained a tremendous amount of primitive characteristics, like teeth. He was asked, well, isn't it true that every subclass of vertebrate, some have teeth and some do not? So how could that show reptilian ancestry? Some fish have teeth and some don't. Some amphibians have teeth and some don't. Other ancient birds had teeth, and some mammals have teeth and some don't. How could you classify teeth as reptilian? He replied he didn't say they were reptilian, but the teeth were primitive. He was then asked, how about man? Does the presence of teeth show him as primitive? He replied, sure. It was pointed out that children have been taught in school that Archaeopteryx was transitional because it had teeth, and we don't want to put that sort of speculation in the textbooks if it proves nothing. He replied, no, you don't. You want to say that it's a primitive holdover. The next question was, are man's teeth a primitive holdover? Are fish's teeth a primitive holdover? They really don't say anything about reptilian ancestry. Dr. Eldridge replied, I know, they are general. They don't tell you anything about the specific relationship with mammals or any group. In the interview, he explained that man's teeth are primitive because we tend to lose them in old age. But he later deleted that statement when he edited the type interview transcript. Dr. Patterson said, he's a different guy, Dr. Patterson said Archaeopteryx, quote, has simply become a patsy for wishful thinking, unquote. And again, from the evolutionist book from Francis Hitching, The Neck of Giraffe, he talks about Archaeopteryx in his book. I'd like to read some about this. He writes, biologists as a whole regard it as an authoritative evidence of Darwinian evolution at work. Quote, it is beyond any argument there existed an animal with both reptilian and bird features, according to one account. Even today, there is no more convincing example of a transitionary link, says another. But is the case for Archaeopteryx quite so unambiguous as these claims make out? Apparently not. Every one of its supposed reptilian features can be found in various species of undoubted birds. One, it had a long bony tail like a reptile's on which feathers grew. His answer, the bone and feather arrangements on present-day swans show striking similarities to Archaeopteryx. Well, two, well, it had claws on its feet and leathered forelimbs. His answer, but so do some modern birds. Three, well, it had bony jaws lined with teeth. It says, many ancient birds did.
particularly those in the Mesozoic, and there's no suggestion that these were intermediates. 4. While it had a shallow breastbone that would have given it a feeble wing beat and poor flight. His answer? Modern woodpeckers, such as the Hootson, have similarly shallow breastbones, and this does not disqualify them from being classified as birds. 5. Well, Archaeopteryx bones were solid like a reptile's, not thin or hollow like a bird's. He answers, another idea that's been drastically revised. The long bones of Archaeopteryx wings and legs are now known to have been both thin and hollow. 6. While Archaeopteryx predates the general arrival of birds by 60 million years. His answer, well, until 1977, Archaeopteryx was uniquely early in the fossil record. But in that year, archaeologists from Brigham Young University discovered in western Colorado a fossil of an unequivocal bird in rocks of the same period as Archaeopteryx. And actually, it's not even birds from the same era. If you study more literature, they found birds 60 million years older than Archaeopteryx. So Archaeopteryx has been propounded as being this mediary bird. But is it? It's just a unique bird type. That's all it is. It's not an intermediary. It definitely does not prove any type of ancestry from one form to another. What about mammals? Back to Sutherland's book, Darwin's Enigma, page 76. He writes, most books and museums' displays on evolution state that mammals originated from reptiles, with the insect eaters, called insectivores, being the first true mammals. Both the placental and marsupial mammals, they contend, evolved in parallel from the reptiles since they have such distinctively different reproductive system. There is a significant difference between reptiles and mammals. Reptiles lay eggs, which have hard shells, and they have scales on their skin. All reptiles have a double-hinged jaw with multiple bones in the jaw and a single bone in each ear. Mammals give birth to their young, have mammary glands, and have hair. They all have a single mandible or lower jaw that's hinged with a single joint on each side, and they all have three bones in the ear, commonly called the hammer, anvil, and stirrup. If the highly complex and integrated structures of mammals slowly and gradually evolved through mutations from the reptiles, the fossil record should show abundant evidence of the transformation. Dr. Raup said he knew nothing of the origin of mammals. He didn't know of any evidence of this transition. And that's true. When it comes to mammals, there just isn't any evidence of the transitional forms. So what have we seen? We've looked at a number of things. We've looked at insects. We've looked at plants. We've looked at the change from invertebrate to vertebrate. We've looked at the evolution of fish, the change from fish to amphibian, from amphibian to reptiles, the origin of snakes, the origin of birds. No transitional forms present. We are looking at mammals and that there is no common ancestry for the family of mammals. And we've seen that there's no common ancestry for much of anything. There's certainly no common ancestry for the life in the Cambrian period. There's no common ancestry for insects. There's no common ancestry for plants. There's no common ancestry for fish or amphibians or reptiles or birds or snakes. It's like, is there anything that has a common ancestry? Amazingly enough, no. There is nothing that has a common ancestry. Gosh, I wish I'd been taught that in school. When I was being taught about evolution in high school and in college, I wish somebody had said to me, by the way, there's absolutely nothing to support what we're teaching you. Mutation doesn't support it. Natural selection doesn't support it. Life from soup doesn't support it. There's not even any soup. And there's certainly nothing in the fossil record to support it. And the horse picture you were shown was a lie. I wish somebody had told me that when I was in school. Maybe I would have looked for God a little earlier. Amazing. I'm talking about mammals to Dwayne Gish's book, Challenge of the Fossil Record, he writes, let us consider comments on the matter from George Gaylord Simpson, one of the world's leading evolutionists. He has said that, quote, the most puzzling event in the history of life on Earth is the change from the Mesozoic, the age of reptiles, to the age of mammals. It is as if the curtain were rung down suddenly on the stage where all the leading roles were taken by reptiles, especially dinosaurs, in great numbers and bewildering variety, and rose again immediately to reveal the same setting, but an entirely new cast, a cast in which the dinosaurs do not appear at all. Other reptiles are supernumeraries, and all the leading parts are played by mammals of sorts barely hinted at in the preceding acts. back to Gish, we might emphasize again the preceding acts covered 120 million years on the evolutionary timescale, lest any evolutionists pretend that there's really no serious problem here. Let him be reminded that Simpson had said that this is the most puzzling event in Earth's history. The problem disappears, of course, if the assumption of evolution is discarded and the creation model of origins is accepted, and that's right. The problem of there being common ancestors anywhere goes out the window completely if you simply assume that things were created like God says they were in the book of Genesis. I'm not going to go into the marine mammals. Dwayne Gish, in his book Challenge of the Fossil Record, discusses the marine mammals, the dolphins, and whatever. But I would like to go to George Rattery Taylor's book, The Great Evolution Mystery, for a sum up on the fossil record. And on page 77 of his book, he has a summary. Here's what he writes. Looking back over the evidence, we see that in each of the major steps, there is almost complete absence of fossils capable of supporting the claim that the new forms arose by the gradual accumulation of minute changes. Eggs are first found fully developed. So are feathers. Fossils of early birds are, quote, extremely rare. Placental mammals appear simultaneously in 12 groups. Some authorities would put the figure higher. Actually, there are some 26 groups of mammals, the origins of which are completely obscure. As for the fishes, quote, we do not know the direct ancestors of the fish, says Professor Lehman. The origin of the insects is a complete mystery. The position as regards the flowering plants is no better. Professor G.G. Simpson is an ardent Darwinist, but he goes so far as to say, quote, the absence of transitional forms is an almost universal phenomenon, end quote. This is true of the invertebrates, as well as vertebrates and also of plants. He adds, quote, the line-making connection with common ancestry is not known even in one instance, end quote. Now that's astounding. Here's an ardent evolutionist who makes the statement that the line-making connection with common ancestry is not known even in one instance, end quote. Oh, gosh, when I was in school, there were all kinds of common ancestry lines that were taught to me. Well, back to Taylor. The rodents, he notes, appear suddenly, already equipped with their specialized gnawing teeth. As to mammals, quote, in all 32 orders of mammals, the break is so sharp and the gap so large that the origin of the order is speculative and much disputed, end quote. Even more recent evolutionary changes are baffling. For instance, the whales and dolphins appear in the fossil record fully formed and diversified. We do not even know what mammalian order they sprang from. Again, in South America, there are puzzles such as those strange and rare creatures, the Gobiidae, with their unique teeth. Quote, these highly specialized animals appear in the fossil record without any antecedents, complained Simpson, and then immediately, geologically speaking, disappear again forever. The problem reaches its acutest form when he considers not classes or orders, but whole phyla. Thus, an enigmatic group of creatures emerged in the Crustaceous, known from the unusual nature of their joints as the condylarths. They are believed to have given rise, in due course, to horses, camels, elephants, and other creatures known today, though the lynx, as usual, are missing. But where did the condylarths come from? Paleontology throws no light on the origin of the phyla, Professor P.P. Grasse's conclusion. As the editor of a 25-volume series, Traité de Zoologie, or however you'd pronounce that in French, he ought to know. It's amazing. Here's an evolutionist writing, there are simply no transitional forms known. The order of descent is not known in even one instance. It does take an amazing faith to believe in evolution. It really does. What about early man? I think many people, you know, we've heard of Neanderthal man and Cro-Magnon man and all the Ramapithecus and the Zinjanthropus and Lucy and all these early people that supposedly provide proof they led up to what we see today in us. Well, I'll point out that Dwayne Gish in his Challenge of the Fossil Record has 98 pages on this subject. 98 pages. And so I'm not going to spend an immense amount of time on this. You can go back and take a look for yourself. Suffice it to say, primate order is a mammalian order. People and gorillas and whatever, the primates, don't have any ancestors either. When I was quoting Taylor and they said the ancestors to the mammals aren't known, that includes the apes and man. Now, Ramapithecus was once supposed to have been an early hominoid. They had found a few teeth and a jaw fragment. It's no longer considered a hominoid. Australopithecus, there were several varieties. They had ape brains, but typically their brain size was a third of that for man. Their teeth were hominoid, yes, but the molars and the less U-shaped jaw than modern man or apes. And Dwayne Gish covers these. What about Lucy? Lucy has received a rather large amount of publicity, so I'd like to read some on her. This is from Gish's book, page 153. It was that of a female, talking about what was found. It was that of a female and was named Lucy by Johansson. This creature was only about 3 1/2 feet tall and had a very small brain, less than 450 cc, which again places it at less a third of that of a modern man. Johansson announced in a press conference that his Lucy was a 3 1/2 million-year-old hominid that walked upright just like modern humans. This brought instant fame to Lucy and to her discoverer. The National Geographic Society promised funds and assigned a photographer to Johansson's expedition. Money came from several sources. Johansson's future was secure. Well, you can read what Gish has to say about Lucy, but she ends up being one of the Australopithecines, which is important to understand. Please note that nothing of ancestry has been proven here. What are discovered are some bone fragments, some teeth, part of a brain or part of a skull or whatever. And then what's assumed is, aha, this is an ancestor to man. That's a huge leap to make, even if an entire family of complete skeletons were found. It's a tremendous leap to then say, this is in the ancestral line to human beings. Now, how about Java Man? You can read about Java Man. In 1891, it was a Dutch physician, Dubois, who found a skull cap. A year later, and 50 feet away, he found a femur bone, and still later after that, he found 3 teeth. And from this, Java Man was constructed. Well, before he died, Dubois himself had decided this was probably a gibbon. What about Peking Man? In the 1920s and 1930s, about 25 miles from Peking, China, were found parts of about 30 skulls, 11 or 12 lower jaw bones, and about 150 teeth and some fragments of some limb bones. Now, the interesting thing about Peking Man was one of the first things found was a single tooth, and that tooth was taken to Professor Davidson Black, who was professor of anatomy at Union Medical College in Peking. He looked at that one tooth, was told about the find, and on the basis of that one tooth, stated that the tooth established evidence for an early man. Excuse me, I seem to see a lack of objectivity here. One tooth, and this is evidence for early man. By the way, with the exception of 2 teeth during World War II, all the evidence disappeared. Now, Nebraska Man. Nebraska Man is really intriguing, and I want to read from The Neck of the Giraffe by Hitching about that, because Nebraska Man is pretty typical in some cases of what goes on when you want to find something, and then you make what you find fit the facts. So Hitching writes, in the early 1920s, before the Tennessee monkey trial of the schoolteacher John Scopes, the teaching of Darwinist evolutionary theory in U.S. schools was even more an educational issue than it is today. William Jennings Bryan, a Nebraskan politician, was vigorously contesting through the courts the idea of children being taught they were descended from apes. In 1922, H.F. Osborne, head of the American Museum of Natural History, received a fossil tooth found in the Pliocene deposits, at least 1 million years old, in Bryan's home state. Osborne was overjoyed. The tooth, he decided, was definitely human-like. There must have lived in those times Nebraska Man, or to give him a dignified Latin tag, Hesperopithecus, or Hesperopithecus. He exulted, the earth spoke to Bryan from his own state of Nebraska. The Hesperopithecus tooth is like the still small voice. Its sound is by no means easy to hear, but this little tooth speaks volumes of truth in that it affords evidence of man's descent from an ape. He was fully supported in England by the most eminent of anatomists. Professor Sir Grafton Elliot Smith of Manchester authorized a detailed reconstruction of Mr. and Mrs. Hesteropithecus that duly appeared in the Illustrated London News, complete with vivid background showing horses and camels in exotic prehistoric surroundings. Alas, the tooth was later identified as belonging to an extinct pig, and today no more is heard of Nebraska Man. It is one of the ironies of history that he nevertheless served his purpose in another famous Darwinian triumph, the Tennessee Monkey Trial of 1925, when John Scopes was accused of teaching Darwin's theory contrary to Tennessee state law. The Hesperopithecus tooth was proudly displayed as evidence that man had a long evolutionary past. So were Eugene Dubois' fossils, even though Dubois himself had ceased to believe in them. And so was Piltdown Man, now known to be the most notorious forgery of all, consisting in a cleverly doctored ape jaw that precisely fitted a modern human skull cap alongside ancient fossil teeth. So the trial that became a turning point in U.S. educational history, not to be significantly challenged for the next half century, was steered toward its verdict by a pig tooth, two dubious fossils subsequently repudiated by their founder, and an outright fake exhibit whose perpetrator is still not known. That's an amazing thing in U.S. history. Piltdown Man, what do we know about Piltdown Man? Again, Gish has information on Piltdown Man. I'll read you a little bit from his book on page 188 of Gish's book. In 1912, Arthur Smith Woodward, director of the Natural History Museum of London, and Charles Dawson, a medical doctor and amateur paleontologist, announced the discovery of a mandible and part of a skull. Dawson had recovered these specimens from a gravel pit near Piltdown, England. The jawbone appeared very simian-like, except for the teeth, which seemed to show the type of wear expected for humans rather than for apes. The skull, on the other hand, appeared to be very man-like. These two specimens were combined and designated Dawn Man. He became known popularly as Piltdown Man. He was judged to be about 500,000 years old, although a few experts, such as Buell and Henry Fairfield Osborne, objected to the association of this very ape-like jaw with the human-like skull. The consensus of the world's great authorities was that Piltdown Man was indeed an authentic link in the evolution of man. Later on, it was discovered that the bones had been treated with iron salts to make them look old, and scratch marks were detected on the teeth, indicating they had been filed. In other words, Piltdown Man was a complete fraud.